our Pesach discussions, time permitting. There are at least two we want to have before Pesach in terms of business Pesach topics. We want to talk about Mechiras Chametz a little bit, and also about the concept of corporation and the implications of stock ownership, which happens to also impact on ownership of Chametz. So since that's on our agenda anyway, that's also something we'd like to get a little bit of insight in before Pesach. I don't know the way. It's also a Ribbis topic, so it a little bit connects Ribbis and Pesach. We'll see if we get up to those things today, time permitting. In any event, we have a major element of Ribbis to discuss, and that is Heter Iska. Before that, just want to add one point. Last week, we were talking about ways in which Ribbis comes up in a business context. One other point that we didn't get up to before we ran out of time is there is also a discussion. Let's say you have a store that has a policy that if somebody buys something and he doesn't like it, he's dissatisfied, so it can be returned to the store and the sale is nullified retroactively. So that also incurs Ribbis problems, theoretically. Why? Because what will happen if that policy... Sorry?
Say the value is different?
Well, the value will stay the same. The problem is, so let's say somebody buys this MP3 player from the store and then returns it a week later and they say, okay, we'll give you back your money. It's as if the sale never happened. So the problem is, what does that do, Yonatan?
You got free usage.
You got free usage. And why did they give you free usage? They give everybody free usage?
What?
They give everybody in the street free usage?
No.
Now, why'd they give you free usage?
They wanted money early.
Because you gave them money early. Now, that's not really why they did it, because they thought they were selling it to you. But essentially, since the sale was canceled, it basically comes out to you loaned them money, and they gave you back the money that you loaned them. And in addition, you also got the usage of this item for however long it was. So that has the appearance of Ribbis.
Is that really their intentions?
No, it's not their intentions. This is definitely a very low-level Drabanan kind of Ribbis issue. But because of the whole phrasing, and it's going to come down a lot to the phrasing, because of the nullification of the sale, so then what was this advancing of the money? It wasn't the sale money. So then it comes out that it was retroactively defined as a loan. So if that's the case, so then it's a loan and you're getting more out of it than you put in. So it comes to be a Ribbis problem. I think it was Yosef, Yonatan, Dubin.
Didn't we say anyways that irrespective of what their intentions might have been, engaging in Ribbis is a problem, so that would make a difference what their intentions
were? Well, it's a little bit of both, because here, at some point, we have money trading and we have different benefits going back and forth. At some point, it's going to be a straight-out business transaction. If there was no intention to ever be lending any money, no intention to ever extract more value out than was being put in, you could see why it's hard to find the Ribbis here. But the elements are there because since we negated the sale, so the money did change hands, so it turns out retroactively that it was a loan. And if it was a loan, it wasn't neutral. The person who loaned the money ended up with more than he loaned. So it's not so obvious that it should be a Ribbis issue, but it ends up being somewhat of a problem. Yonatan?
If the buyer planned on doing it the whole time,
mm-hmm. Probably not. No, definitely not, because he didn't condition it. It's an interesting ethical question in general, which is a little bit outside this topic, but it's in other areas. Right? The question of buying stuff with the intent to return it, which theoretically should be an ethical problem. The complication is that you have businesses today that are very overt in saying they don't have a problem with it. So it's hard to have an issue if they knowingly are okay with it, but it's still somewhat hard to believe that you can buy an item and use it to your heart's content and then give it back without having paid anything for it in the long run, and the store is okay with that. It definitely does have the taste of some type of theft connected to it. But normally the premise is you'll return something because there's something defective about it. So if the idea is that you're doing this on purpose, knowing that you're going to not find it satisfactory, you'll claim not to find it satisfactory, so that seems to have many levels of problem with it. However, you also have businesses which say straight out that they're not totally okay with that. But take it, use it, give it back, no questions asked, and that's our policy. You can't force them to be machbid. If that's the way they want to do business and it's a successful model for them, then somehow it works. They have the right to give you stuff for free if they want to. If they openly say, this is what we do, yes, I know. If you go up to the store and say, listen, I'm buying this, and I'm going to use it for a week and give it back to you, and there's nothing wrong with it, but I'm telling you right now I'm going to do that. And they say, you know, that's fine. That's our policy. Because it's hey. So essentially, and the person is empowered to do that. If the person represents the genuine policy of the store, he's not just a worker who doesn't care about the store. So any interaction between two people, you can't force somebody to be makbid, again, with the exception of ribbis, which is its own story. But from the theft perspective and dishonest perspective, if you're coming telling him the whole story and he says it's okay, it's a funny situation because it feels like it is morally problematic, but if they're telling you that this is the way they do it, it's hard to be more makbid on their behalf than they are. In any event, but that's separate from the ribbis consideration. So here, just it's never going to be ribbis ksutza because you'd have to really, first of all, ribbis in a business context already is knocked down to a drabana, and it's not ksutza like this. But separate from those concerns, we're worried that it's going to end up being retroactively a loan where they make more profit. So a lot of this has to do with the phrasing, and one of the easy ways to address it is that the store should have the policy that we will not retroactively negate your sale. Instead, we will buy it back from you. If they say we'll buy it back from you, so then that recharacterizes everything. The product was yours during that time, and now they bought it back from you. They're willing to buy it back for the same price as they sold it to you, despite the fact that it's a little bit used. Okay, so that's their policy, but that doesn't necessarily have to be defined as ribbis. So it's really a question, a little bit of the mindset and the terminology. Dubin?
Doesn't the Gemara on Yevdalah, if you sell someone stolen land, that you're allowed to pay them back?
But you're allowed
to be a question if you're allowed to give them Shevach also.
You're allowed to pay who back?
You're allowed to pay the Lokeach back.
Because he got the land taken away from him.
Yeah.
So you can now reimburse. So you think that should look like ribbis to me? Because it's going to...
Well, there's a discussion of merits. We'll focus paying the Shevach also as ribbis, but there's no discussion of the land itself.
The land itself, you're saying therefore it should be comparable to a purchase in that sense, because it was a loan? Comes out to be, since he got the land taken back from him, so it wasn't a sale, so retroactively it's defined as a loan. Except that's not really the case. It's really that it was a sale, but he's essentially has a nezik at your hands, that he paid money that he ended up losing because it turned out to be a stolen object. So whatever he paid for the land was basically a hezik. So you're responsible for the hezik because you put him in that position. It's not really a loan. Here in the case of the sold item, this is the deal between us, that I don't really have any obligation to give it back to you. I'm giving it back because those are the terms. I'm willing to retroactively negate your sale. So that makes it into a loan type of context. So there are a couple of remedies. Rabbi Reisman talks about this in his book on ribbis. Rabbi Levine talks about this in one of his books, more than one of his books. There are a number of remedies. It does boil down a lot to the phrasing, that if the understanding is the store is buying it back from you rather than negating your sale retroactively, so that should help a lot. It was even suggested that you could condition it the opposite way. You can say that you have the right to a money-back refund if you don't like it, and if we refuse to give it to you, then the sale is negated because of violation of our terms. So then, if you do return it, the idea is you bought it, it was yours, but you're trading it back for your full refund. And then everything is in the context of a business transaction rather than a loan, and it shouldn't run afoul of any of these ribbis issues. Okay, so that was just the one point to add on from those examples we were discussing last week. Avi?
It just sounds, I don't want to say like fishy.
Okay, so don't say that.
If I could say that, it does, because
okay,
you're not paying him back for the tax price, but at the end of the day, you're giving that back.
You're not paying him back for...
When a guy buys something from me,
right?
Theoretically speaking, I pay him $10, and he gives me another $2 for tax, let's say.
The purchaser pays another $2
right.
for that, right?
Now, I'm going to buy it back from him because I understand that he doesn't want it anymore and I can sell it. I'll give him $12. Why am I giving him $12 for an item which I know I'm only going to sell for $10? And $2 of those I'm just going to happen to forward back to the government. Like, it seems like the most...
Yeah, I don't know if that really has to bother us, especially because it wasn't a straight-out issue to begin with. You know, it became a loan only kind of accidentally, circumstantially. Certainly not a ribbis deraisa problem. So the addressing it through characterizing it as a sale, which you have the right to set the rate whatever you want, doesn't seem to be that problematic.
And does the customer need to know that's what he's doing? The mashal, you have a non-religious, Jew walk into your store. So you may say, okay, we term our sale as repurchasing. He's like, okay, whatever, I'm returning this to you. Take it back, give me back my money. Is that do you have to insist, no, I need you, sir, Mr. Rosenberg, even though you're not necessarily religious, I need you to put on the charade with me?
Mr. Rosenberg, it's not a charade. It's, if anything, it's as legitimate, it's important, especially as we have to talk about Hitariska, be careful about the language. I don't think it's a charade. It's just a question of understanding what is the characterization of what's going on. But presumably,
you have to get a shear to every guy who walks into your store.
Right. No. So it's you don't have to go into so much detail. The question is just to understand. Listen, you bought this, and we'll be happy to buy it back from you. That's our policy. We buy back items that are not.
But there has to be a knowledge.
I mean, if you phrase it the other way,
I'm wondering just because this is so prevalent in Israeli society.
To phrase it as a retroactive loan is.
I haven't seen a phrase of that. I think most people just.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that it's overtly phrased the other way. So I think you can probably leave it to be assumed that this is what you mean. It's under that understanding. Hi.
Sorry, just piggybacking on that. So this needs to be their intention for it not to be a problem, right? That it's
well, certainly you want to avoid the other intent. You want to avoid the phrasing where you're saying that it's a retroactive sale, a retroactive negation of the sale. Also, if you buy it back, especially if the store doesn't give you full price, some stores subtract a restocking fee, or other types of things, that also makes it better. So an easier way to do it is if you say, we'll give you back less than 100%, and we'll subtract something for the usage.
Do we have some sort of obligation to find out what their intent, how their system works? Asking someone in the store, how do you see the transaction that we're doing right now? Because depending on what you might say, you may or may not be allowed to engage in that transaction.
See, it's interesting. If you put all the parts together, there's very little burden on the purchaser because the purchaser, you have enough sfeikis to put together since you're dealing with a derabanan after the fact that doesn't even have a mitzvah to return it, probably even lots of the shemayim probably at that level. And in any event, the money that you're getting back is the keren. So we mentioned last week that there was a machlokas about whether you could say that what was paid in advance was the interest. So the usage is clearly the interest part, and the purchase price was the principal. So there's very little burden that's really going to fall on the purchaser's shoulders in terms of that. So just something to be aware of. In any event, so now the main topic for today, let's get up to the Hetariska issue. A few words about the concept. It is it's a highly debated idea. The concept of a Hetariska was really put into usage about 400 years ago, in the 1600s. It's mostly associated with a Polish Talmud Chacham, whose name was Rabbi Nachum Mendel of Wigders. Was a contemporary of the Bach. The theory, the concept exists in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, but the usage, the way it's put into practice today, is a much later development. And what it seems to be is a mechanism to allow what would otherwise be characterized as lending money with interest as something else. Now, is that something we're okay with? Are we basically, to use obvious term, is this a charade? Are we essentially evading the law? So we hope not, but there is some controversy about the usage of ribbis. It's not the usage of heteriska. It hasn't been always endorsed. I think Rabbi Shechter tells a story about somebody who died, and after he died, somebody else had a dream about him. And the guy looked horrible after he had died, not surprisingly, but even worse than the dead person should look. And they asked him in the dream, why do you look so bad? I think that Vilna Gaon related the story, maybe, if I remember correctly. He said, why do you look so bad? And he said, because I'm in trouble upstairs in Shemayim. They nailed me on ribbis. So the person says to the guy in the dream, but you were always careful to use a hatariska. Why should you be in any trouble for ribbis? And the man responded, that no, they only accept the heteroskia down here. Upstairs, they don't accept it. So there is some discussion about whether or not it's something that we're totally comfortable with. And in the earlier generations, you find the commentaries in the Shulchan Aruch emphasizing that you shouldn't try, and the Torah talks about this, that you shouldn't try any type of a way around the prohibition of charging ribbis. But nonetheless, you find in recent generations more of an acceptance of this type of a mechanism. And one of the poskim of the last generation, the Chelkis Yaakov, Reb Yaakov Breisch, has a long essay about this and an introduction to Tshuvas that he has about the heteriska, where he illustrates a whole different attitude, and he says that this is something that we have to allow, because if we don't allow it, then we're not going to be able to survive as a culture, we're not going to be able to do business, and it's important that we be able to have some mechanism that we can do business effectively. Now, that's not the whole story. That's not everything. Now, it's important to understand, especially in light of our opening lecture in this class, where we talked about Lishnin Mishuras Adin, and we emphasized in that context that we want to try to always go above and beyond the law, at least when it makes sense, at least when it is a reflection of the values contained within the law. So wouldn't want to argue that at the very least, if you're utilizing the heteriska, you're failing on that level. So the answer is hopefully no. That essentially, as will become clear when we explain it, the situations when you use the heteriska are situations where the spirit of the law is not being violated. And it's only the letter of the law that is a problem. And it's only in such a situation where a heteriska is appropriate. If the spirit of the law would indicate otherwise, so then that itself would be a reason not to use the heteriska. But also, you'll see once we explain it, but it's not even clear it makes sense in those circumstances. So what I'm trying to say is that there are times when a heteriska is appropriate, and there are times when it's not appropriate. And when it's not appropriate either or both of two reasons, because it may go against the spirit of the law of ribbis, as well as the letter of the law. Or also, and very likely together with that, it doesn't even make sense within the concept of heteriska, as will become clear in a moment. So the first thing we should emphasize before we even talk about it is we'll acknowledge that there was a debate about whether or not it's appropriate to use such a mazel tov to our chassan.
Mazel
tov. How exciting. So, special Mario Benitana. So the question of whether it's appropriate or not is going to depend on the circumstances, but the general appropriateness of heteriska has been the topic of great debate. By acknowledging that debate, it's important for us to understand that we don't approve of any method to try to avoid the spirit of the law, and that's something that's also going to be a good introduction to our Mechiras Chametz discussion as well, and we'll try to keep that in our context. But it's very important, I think, that we are sensitized to that theory before we start talking about it. So hopefully, as we talk about the details, that will become clear that that's our goal. And before we even talk about it, I think it's important to keep that in mind. So to have your antenna open for that, that we're looking to try to maintain the spirit of the law and the letter of the law. And we only even talk about the heteriska when the spirit of the law is hopefully not relevant in the way that the ribbis would make sense. So I think Brett was up first, then Divin.
I'm going to hold off my question.
See how it plays out.
Yeah.
Okay. Divin?
Did the approach of the Chelkei Yaakov contradict our Evuna?
No, because it depends on the circumstances. It depends on the... It's interesting, this conversation also comes up in the context of Hetzer Mechira and Shvius. Everything has different circumstances. And especially, let's focus first on ribbis specifically, and we'll see why it come out a little bit differently. That, especially the way we explained ribbis when we first started talking about it, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, so we understood the nature of the Isser ribbis to have something to do with the mandate of chesed. There's different explanations along these lines, but that it all stems from that if somebody is in need of help, is in need of assistance, and you can help them because you have the funds available. So it's not right for you to charge extra for that. It's not right for you to ask for interest. So that will always be the case, that the heteristic is not designed to allow you to subvert that principle. And if somebody comes and says to you, I need money for the rent, I'm going to get kicked out, I need money for groceries this week, so if you're able to help them, so then it's your mitzvah to help them. And that would not be the right time to say, okay, here's my heteristic to work out how you're going to pay me interest on this. It wouldn't be the right time morally, and it wouldn't probably even work in terms of how a heteristic operates. Ariel?
Is that assuming that the guy is legit, he's not, you know, some...
So that's a fair question to ask in general about whether you want to get involved with somebody who you don't trust. So in general, the obligation of stopping towards somebody who might not be legit is itself a question. But it's even more of a question when you're dealing with a loan, because you do have the right to guarantee you're going to get your principal back. So that, in fact, it's an interesting, the Torah even has a very unusual mitzvah, which some of the Sfarim actually counted as an obligation. It's hard to understand that the loaner should take collateral. So you might say, why should we care that he takes collateral? If he's willing to lend without collateral, so why should he be obligated to take collateral? So it's a fascinating discussion where that comes from. But it kind of emphasizes the fact that it's certainly legitimate for the lender to only get involved if he can guarantee he'll get his principal back. That we don't have a problem with. It's the question of a profit beyond that, that I'm only involved in the chesed if it make it worth my while, and the mitzvah is not enough to make it worth my while. That's where we get into somewhat of a sticky situation. So the Chafetz Chaim also emphasized, I think I mentioned, that the Sefer Avos Chesed that was written by the Chafetz Chaim, a huge proportion of it is about the mitzvah of lending money. And he writes there that there's a big chesed involved in lending money, but the chesed, the mitzvah component, is really only there if you do it without any such mechanisms, if you're not trying to get any type of extra any way in which you do it. If you're looking for the mitzvah chesed, so then that's not a time to try to get extra, whether it's through explicit interest or whether it's through any other type of mechanism. So heteriska is really not for that. So what is a heteriska for? Heteriska is really for the business world. It's really for the setting where we now have a culture where much of the profit that is made and much of the functioning of the business world requires that there be interest built in. And that interest, conceptually, does not run afoul of what the Torah is saying. It's not a undermining of the mandate of chesed, but it happens to be technically prohibited. Letter of the law prohibited, because it does amount to agar naturally. It does amount to a reward that's there for waiting. So if that's the case, how do we address the letter of the law when we're confident that the spirit of the law is not an issue in this case? So there was a mechanism that was, again, popularized in the past couple hundred years, but it's based on an expression that appears in the Gemara, but we'll see it towards the end. But the Gemara there talks in general about the whole concept of investment, of an iska. If somebody gets involved in giving money to somebody else for a business venture, so how do you categorize that? What's the nature of person A, I give Yosef money to invest in the business? So what exactly is the context? What exactly is the nature of what's going on? So the Gemara has an expression which is incorporated into the basic iska. We'll discuss today, there are probably three types of iskas that are in use, which means many more than that, because every individual might have his own understanding of how an iska should be written. But even accounting for those differences, there are three types, three categories of iskas. But the first basic heteriska model is called palga malva, palga halva, and palga pikado. Chatzi malva, chatzi pikado. That basically is structured as half of a loan and half investment. So let's say I wanted to lend you $1,000 for your business. You wanted to use $1,000. You're not a poor person who can't pay the rent. You are somebody who's wanting to start a business, and you need capital. So I'm happy to give you $1,000 for that, and I would want $100 interest. I want 10% interest. Now, we can't do that, technically, because that's a river sprout. However, what if it was phrased like this? This $1,000 that I'm giving you, let's cut it in half. $500 will be a loan. And that $500, I don't want any interest. You pay back just principal, $500. I lend you $500, you give me back $500, no problem. The other $500, that's going to be an investment. I want you to take my $500 and protect it from me. Invest it in your business, do whatever you do to make a profit, and I want a return on my investment. Now, ultimately, how much return am I going to want? I'm going to want 20%. Because in order to get the same $1,100 total that I wanted originally, I'm going to need 20% of the investment to come back, because only half of it is the investment, $500. So I need $100 back, that's 20% of $500. So instead of 10% interest, I need 20% return on the investment tax. So on the surface, that's how the investor ends up with $1,100 when he puts down $1,000, when otherwise, if he was able to lend with interest, he would lend $1,000 and get back $1,100. So now, hold on a second. How do we know that the return on his investment is going to be 20%? It could be any number. It could be nothing. He could lose the whole principal. The business might go under. So how does it work out that the investment ends up yielding the same number that this investor wanted to begin with? So the way that operates is that really it should fluctuate. I can give you $500 to invest, and the money that I get back beyond that $500 should really depend on the business. If you had a very successful business, it should be a lot. If you didn't do so well, it should be less. If you lost the whole thing, it should be nothing. I shouldn't even get my principal back. It should all be based on that. However, look at it this way. Let's say I give you $500 to invest in business. And you come back and you tell me that $500 you gave me, all gone. I tried the business. It was a failure. I lost everything. Sorry. Got nothing for you. So I'll say to you, yeah, for sure you're going to say that. You have every interest in telling me that your business was a failure because now you get to keep the money. So why should I believe you when you come back and tell me the business didn't go well? If you want me to continue investing in you so you're disincentivized to tell me that you messed up the business, but let's say this is a one-time thing, so you have every motive to come back and lie to me. Right? You have every motive to come back and say, oh, didn't go well. Whole thing was a bust, so sorry, your money's all gone. And for all I know, you made millions and you're pocketing all my profits and all my original investment. So I'll say to you, if you want to come back and tell me that the money was lost or that I didn't get my 20% return that I was expecting, I'm going to demand a very high standard of proof. And I'm also going to demand that the different versions of this, these are just in different permutations, I'm going to demand that you take a shvua in Beis Din, that that's what happened. And if you're learning Bar Mitzvah this year, so you know a little bit how hesitant we are to engage in a shvua. And I'm going to want witnesses also. You know who I want? I want you to bring your rabbi and your shamus to come and testify that you lost all the money and you should take a shvua. Now listen, if you don't want to go through all of that to prove to me that you lost the money, I'll give you an escape clause. We will set a flat rate. This 20% is what I expect to get back. And if you don't want to prove to me what the exact number is, you'll have this alternative venue. If you pay me back this set rate, then we can assume that that's what it was and you won't have to prove to me. And then the assumption is that the individual is not going to want to go through all that to prove that he has anything less than the 20% that was expected. And he'll take this alternative and he'll pay back 20%. So that is the basic thrust of how it works. That essentially we convert half of it to a loan and half of it to an investment. The investment has this predetermined rate of return because otherwise the threshold of proof is too arduous and the borrower would rather take this pre-agreed rate as reflecting the profits on the investment. I think Brett, then Joseph?
So, two things. One, that means that we're really limiting this to business ventures.
So right, so that's...
The loan on a house wouldn't necessarily qualify.
Well, we'll discuss that. It's a discussion, but your opening premise is correct that it's
not a revenue-generating venture, so then you can't share the profits.
That's the question that you could ask about this. There's a way of dealing with it, but that's the initial assumption, which is what I was alluding to before, where I said it's not just that it's against the spirit of the law to use a heteroscope for a loan for somebody's rent, but the logic doesn't even make sense. It's not even clear that it would even be effective, or it's unlikely that it would even be effective because it doesn't fit the concept at all. So the concept is already dependent on the idea that there's some kind of profit coming in.
Okay, and the second one is, so let's say somebody's business is failing,
mm-hmm.
and now they still have to pay this 20%, not interest, but investor interest to the investor. Wouldn't the person who was invested in, the person paying the interest, rather in that scenario, bring the higher burden of proof and have that person share in the profits and losses rather than continue paying 20%?
Possibly. Yes, and then that's not necessarily a bad thing. They might do that. They might do that anyway. And that's not the only risky scenario. Let's say, for example, the guy comes to you and says, I want to borrow $1,000 because I have to make an investment. I heard this great plan. This guy Madoff, you should meet him. He's got this great plan. I'm going to invest my money with him. I'm definitely going to do very well. And then I'll give you back a return. So then the guy comes back to the investor and he says, oh, Madoff, he lost all my money, he's going to jail. So the guy didn't say, I don't believe you, bring me proof. It's on the cover of every newspaper in the world. You know, there's not a single person on the planet who doesn't know that Madoff lost everybody's money. So there are going to be circumstances where it's not credible to say you don't believe the guy. If you say, I want to build a shawarma place, and everyone knows the shawarma place burnt down to the ground, and everyone can see that it's... destroyed. So it's not going to necessarily be credible. So the truth is, there are scenarios where the person is taking on somewhat of a risk. Right? That, in general, the difference in definition between a loan and an investment is that a loan, especially from a halachic perspective, but also from an economic perspective, taking the two together, so a loan, there is no permissible extra, there is no permissible increase, but the principal is guaranteed. Not 100% guaranteed, because the guy could go bankrupt or the guy could lose all everything, but in theory it's guaranteed to the extent that he can pay it. While an investment, it's permissible to take extra, but the basic principal is not guaranteed. Everything could get lost. So by making a part of this into an investment, the truth is the lender is taking a risk. And if he was willing to just lend out his $1,000 without looking for any increase, he could make a $1,000 loan with no interest, and he'd be more protected. By making it partially a picadon, the part that is a picadon is to some degree at risk.
So
we've kind of inoculated. It is possible. Right, it is possible that he could end up invoking that clause. You know, I'm willing to take a shvuah, I'm willing to bring the rabbi and the chazan, or the circumstances are just such that it's not credible to say you don't believe me. Bernie Madoff's in jail, everyone knows. So that's both good and bad. You know, maybe it's bad because you think the lender's not going to want to do this anymore, but it's good because because the more that there is some degree of risk, the more this is really legitimately characterized as an investment. It's a relatively safe investment, but we want to believe that it is actually an investment to some degree, and therefore the fact that he has some remote possibility of risk conceptually makes it better. So that's the main element. The main element is the structuring of the loan into a half loan, half investment, with this way of fixing the investment return at a specific number. Now, there's another element also, which people who get involved with hetereskes and don't know the lumdus find very strange. But what also happens is that the lender gives the borrower a dollar. Where does that come from? People always ask this. Yeah, I signed the hetereska and the guy gave me a dollar. What's that based on? So, Chesky, you want to explain it?
Is that what you're working on?
Right. So why do we care about that?
So now the object's still completely in your possession, and he's just going to be, handling it. And if he ends up messing it up, then he has to pay back for it in any situation. But now since you're paying him for it, it doesn't look like it. It's just like he's not borrowing money from you. He's being paid to handle your money.
So that's part of it, which is to say a little bit more completely, that basically the issue is like this. So what happened was I gave this guy two things. I gave him a $500 loan, and I said, here's $500, go grow it for me. Go work to make it increase for me. So why should he work for me? Why should he increase my money? Why should he take the effort to go make my $500 worth more? Because he's grateful that I'm lending it to him? Lending him the other $500? Uh-oh, that's ribbis. All right, what's his motivation to take my $500 and make it grow into something bigger? If his motivation is because he's grateful that I lent him the other $500, that's a problem. So why should he work for free otherwise? So we don't want him working for free. Now that concern can be remedied with a very token payment. It's a whole discussion in the literature what exactly qualifies as a token payment. In some svarim it says the smallest amount somebody would take for any menial task. There's a question how you arrive at what the number is, but nowadays it often comes out to be a dollar. But the point being that you give a very small token amount to the borrower, so the borrower is now working for free. Because if he was working for free, it looks like his only motivation to do this is to thank you for the loan that he got. Hi.
Since we're saying this, let's say it's 20%, I'm saying that from before. Mm-hmm. So now he knows that if he makes 40%, then he gets 20% also, which is an incentive.
What incentive for him to take the alternate?
What?
Which is a reason for him to stick to this, to stick to the shtar and not to.
That's an incentive. You don't need to pay him. So I mean, you're telling him that. I don't know how much you're getting back, but I'm getting like 20% either way. So if you make more.
But we can't really consider that an incentive because, besides the fact that it's not realistic, which point that we'll address in a second. But, the theory is that the rate that he's paying you back is the actual return. Now, it stands in for the actual return because we're not going to go through the process of trying to establish what it is. So it's hard to say that he should take any encouragement in the fact that he's getting more than he's getting return off the other guy's investment because we're not really recognizing that there is such return because the 20% represents his return. So can't do anything with the 40% if it should ever happen because we're not really recognizing it exists. I think Brett, then Joseph.
So I guess I don't really understand the second way because if, like you said, if he grows 40%, then the borrower gets to keep 20% too. So isn't that enough compensation?
So again, let's assume for a second that's realistic it's going to happen. Bottom line is that that's not really something that's going to motivate anybody because it's highly unlikely. Right, but it's highly unlikely that everyone's going to make 40% back on their.
I mean, if they weren't going to make more than 20%, they probably wouldn't borrow in the first place.
No, because for this loan, it makes sense, but they're not putting in any of their money in that. But a business in general is not going to make that type of a return over the capital that's put into it.
Okay. So I'm having trouble understanding the mechanics.
The idea is that basically you're not putting in anything. You're putting in the other guy's money. So, and he's getting back more than he put in, so that's fine. So, in terms of the percentage, it's unlikely that a business is going to return 40% of its capital on top of what you actually put in. So, in real life, it's hard to believe that's actually a motivation for you to do something. That's A. But B, even if it were, it would still be hard for us to consider that his motivation because, as far as we're concerned, he's giving back to the investor all of his returns. It's just that we use the 20% figure to stand in for the return.
That's a
So to say that, well, it's really less and he's motivating himself for the difference, we can't really deal with that difference because we're not really acknowledging that difference exists. We're using the 20% as a stand-in, whether he actually makes 5% or 10% or 40%, so it's hard to use it to compare against anything else. Hi.
Is that a real issue? Like, why would anyone give you a dollar then?
So it's more of a symbolic issue that we have to have some type of at least an official arrangement. And there is, again, a discussion whether a dollar is really sufficient. How exactly are we coming to this number? But it's not that he's got to be motivated in the sense that this is enough to support his family. He's got to be motivated in the sense that he's not doing something for nothing. You know, so we find also in American contract law, you know, that if two people make a deal and there's nothing in it for one party, then one of the parties, the contract is void because there has to be consideration. There has to be something token in it for you. So this is a token consideration. He needs to have a dollar so that he's on a very low level, a very cheap sweatshop laborer. I think was Chesky first.
Just to clarify, so when we talk about this, like 20% that you're going to be taking, it's not 20% of the profit; it's 20% of your initial loan. Like
right.
If you gave
yes.
$100, you're going to get back 120.
Correct.
Okay.
It's 20% of the initial, not the loan. 20% of the pecadon part.
Correct. Right. It's guaranteed that.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. So that's the basic structure of a standard heteroskew. Now. Joseph, you had a question?
It's not specifically this, but it's just pretty much in general.
Mm-hmm.
Have we addressed, like, that it seems like, at least from what we spoke about last semester, the Torah has a built-in economic system to cause things to return to a default so that you won't have inflation built in. And nowadays, obviously inflation has to be factored in. If you had a contract with someone from 1970, mm-hmm. they would do $50,000, they hadn't paid you for whatever reason, now in 2012, 2013, that would be worth $400,000. Oh, well, I owe you $50,000, too bad we're Jewish. But obviously in the Torah, you always give the same amount of tzedakah, machat tzedashek. It's all these things are measured.
Are you saying, if I understand it correctly, you're saying that since the halacha views money is fixed, and but the fact is, over the long term, money is not really fixed.
Yeah, in modern society, it doesn't function.
So that's part of the justification to.
In general, ribbons. If you run someone $10,000, they pay that next year. It's not nearly $10,000.
Yeah, but you certainly can't simply pay the person the higher number based on inflation, because that would for sure be ribbons. But you're saying in terms of the spirit of ribbons, that if you're only accounting for inflation.
You're not taking interest, nothing to break.
It definitely would be ribbis straight up. You're saying a justification why it's not a violation of the spirit is if you're only accounting for inflation.
Right, exactly.
That could be true, except that's not necessarily what you're doing with this loan. You're actually going to expect more. You want a return, not just the inflation. So that won't be the whole justification. So the spirit of the law of justification would have to be that you're not helping the guy out with his rent, or the guy's not in a chesed situation. It's essentially a person who wants to profit through business, so he needs your help to profit. So essentially it is an investment, but it's an investment where you would want to guarantee a certain half of it in the form of a loan. So we'll let you do that. Guarantee part of it as a loan, and the rest is an investment. Now it prompts the question that Brett asked before, I don't know if he's looking to come back to that question, but now what about then defining what we'll use it for. So it seems like you should only use it for businesses. So on the surface, that is the case. It really is limited to businesses. But it's also been understood by a lot of poskim to extend to, for example, house loans, because a house is also an investment. House hopefully will go up in value. So therefore, it's legitimate to see a house in that category, to see a house as something that the original lender is investing in. And then it's also been extrapolated a little bit further, it's a little bit more controversial, but student loans as well, which our yeshiva lends out to students with interest and using a heteriska. We discussed a little bit, or touched upon the point, it's a good question whether or not why you were subject to prohibitions of ribbis. Is it considered to be a corporation, a person, a stock, whatever it is? But they do utilize a heteriska for the student loans, if I'm not mistaken, under the assumption that a student loan is also a capital investment, in a sense. A person is going to get an education, use that education to earn more money in the future. So therefore, student loans are also in this category. That's a little bit more of a stretch, and there are those who are not so comfortable with this. In fact, there are some who say that, let's say you have a certain debt, and in order to address the debt, you're going to have to quit your job and do something else, take care of the debt, and because you have a loan to help you with the debt, you can keep doing your job and making money, so therefore that's the justification for a heter isko. Also, there are those who have maintained such a svara, and others who have very much disagreed. Others who said they don't think that that's at all a legitimate application, because then you can make anything into profit generating that way. You can say that any type of financial crisis I need to have solved, otherwise I'll have to stop doing anything profitable. And not everyone accepted the idea that a heter isko could be expanded into those categories. So the bottom line is that you're right, that really it's only meant for businesses, and that's true both because of its letter of the law, spirit of the law concerns, and because the mechanism, the whole premise is that you're making a profit. If you're not making a profit, the words don't make sense. So that's that is true. And then the question is what's included? So many poskim have agreed that house mortgages are included. Student loans are a little bit more of a stretch, but has also been included. And then the question, how far you want to go. But again, we can agree that helping the almana with her rent is not considered to be an appropriate time for the heter isko to be invoked. Hi.
I was wondering, how is lending students money in capital investment?
Because once they finish their education, don't you realize that once you finish your university education, you will take this education and you'll make a fortune in the open market. So you're investing in your degree.
Why does it benefit?
Yeah, well, no, the student benefits. So because
the students benefit.
Yeah, they're investing in the student. The student's going to make a fortune with that, and then he will share part of his good fortune with his investor. That's basically the idea. Student loan is basically somebody backing the student's future potential as an earner. That's what it's supposed to be. In this sense, that's how it's understood.
Who says the student's going to give back?
Well, if he takes a loan, he's going to give back.
Right.
So, but the idea is the investor is backing a student, just like he would back any other commodity that was going to make money. So too, he's assuming the student is going to, because of his education, is going to be better prepared to make a higher salary, and it's essentially an investment. Brett?
So in the second way that we said, where the person pays the lender pays $1 for addition, basically, who owns the business?
So the business presumably is still owned by the borrower, especially because the borrower never actually sold the business to anybody, never explicitly said that he was doing that. The investor owns his money. That's all he.
I thought we're saying.
And he doesn't even own it. He has a. Hey, I guess he owns it theoretically. Right? It's a cousin. He owns it, but not the business itself. The business itself. However you identify a business as a commodity, which itself is a little bit of a challenge. Either if you mean the pizza store, meaning the building and the ovens, etc., so then presumably the borrower owns all that.
Well, the borrower, he's using the money as consignment. He's using this money, he's investing it for the sake of paying returns to the...
So you want
to
say it should be as if wherever he does, but if he buys an oven for his pizza place, it should be as if the investor bought that oven.
It's the lender's pizza place, and the person is just managing the money, managing the operations. He's going to pay his wage. So you have a manager of a restaurant. The manager doesn't own it. He runs all the operations.
Right. No, I hear where you're coming from, except it seems to be it's at a remove, because he's not actually saying, okay, I want you to take this money and start a restaurant.
But the
he's saying,
coming to him and saying, here, I want to start a restaurant. He's saying, okay, I'm going to. Correct,
but that's just his way of taking the money and maximizing it. Essentially, the understanding is that the investor is saying, take my $500 and make it $600. And however you do that, you want to do it this way, you want to do it that way. You know, maybe I want to know about it so I'll know that I can trust you, that you're going to do a good job at it, but I don't really care how you do it. Now, you're also opening an interesting question, which if you look at some of the different ISCA forms, if you Google, you know, ISCA, you can find various forms. The RCA has a form which should be available somewhere. The RCA Besdin, but Starkey has one. There's different forms that are out there. If you Google them, you see some of the differences. So some of the forms, they say, in order to kind of enhance the investment component, so they ask the person to specify what's he going to do with it. They explain what kind of business he's going to go into. Others would say that that's not a good idea, because again, if we want to preserve the ability of the person to credibly say, I don't believe you if you lost the money. So it's better if we know as little as possible about what he's doing. He says, I have some business, and whatever it is, doesn't matter. He says, very specifically, I have this money, I want to borrow it so I can start a burger place on Amsterdam Avenue, so then it's going to be very hard for the lender to deny knowing what happened with that burger place. So that itself has its ups and downs. Just to go back to the mortgage point for a second, it's also an interesting thing to be aware of, that if somebody takes out a mortgage, or many other such loans, so even if they use the heter iska, so there will still be many other documents that use the traditional language, or the untraditional language of mortgage, interest, et cetera, which all is the language of a loan. So is that a contradiction to the heter iska, which says it's not a loan, says it's an investment? So here again, the general consensus has been not to see that as a contradiction, but perhaps it should be put into the heter iska form that there are other documents accompanying this transaction which use language such as mortgage, interest, etc. We are choosing to use this language to facilitate the process vis-a-vis the secular court system, but the actual characterization is as we've set it out in this heter iska. And of course the hope is that dealing between two Jewish people, that if there is any question about anything, it will go to Beis Din, and Beis Din will understand it as per the iska. If it ends up in a secular court, which itself is a halachic problem, but if for whatever reason it ends up in a secular court, so then the secular court will, based on that language, disregard the heter iska.
Chesky? I pulled it up a few books.
From whose? From which one?
Yeah, based in America. They haven't started their agreement. They mentioned the $1 thing.
So what, you want to read the whole thing? It's probably two paragraphs.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Could you just pull it up on the screen?
I, the other side, have received from blank sum of blank or payable over blank years for the purpose of transacting business in connection with blank, in which profits and losses are to be equally shared. However, the said blank has agreed that in lieu of such sharing of profits and losses, which would require substantiation of all losses by two trustworthy witnesses and verification of all profits by oath, he shall accept my payment of an annual percentage of blank percentage of the said sum of blank, and waive all other profits which may be earned from the advanced funds. I have received a token payment of $1 from the said blank for my efforts in connection with the undertaking, and signed herewith the receipt of the said blank, signed the statement, etc. And then they have, prior to that, a whole little introduction explaining what exactly we're doing here. Specifically, it's considered profit rather than interest on a loan.
Okay, so hopefully, in light of what we just said, so you understand what that document means. So that's the standard heter iska. Now, there are at least two other, and by the way, understanding it's also important, but Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he notes that a heter iska is not a magical incantation. It's not that you just invoke this and you therefore erase all ribbis problems, but the assumption is that you will understand on some level what's being said, and that relates back to the question Avi and Yosef were asking before about the store and the characterization of the purchase. So here all the more so that it should be understood between the parties that this is what the heter iska is meant to accomplish. It is recharacterizing the arrangement in such and such a way. So there is another model that was utilized also, that some poskim suggested, that has pluses and minuses, that there were those who said, listen, why do we have to get involved with this whole headache? Why should we do a half loan, half pikadon? Let's just do a full pikadon version. Let's just characterize the entire transaction as a pikadon. I'm giving you $1,000 to invest, and I expect back a 10% return. Instead of saying I'm lending you $500 and giving you $500 to invest with a 20% return, I'll give you $1,000 to get a 10% return. So, what's the pluses? Should I just explain first?
Can you repeat that?
That sounds like exactly Ribbis.
No, it's the opposite of Ribbis. That basically, in the original form, so at all of these situations, the guy wants to give $1,000 and get back $1,100. So, in the Ribbis formulation, I'll lend you $1,000 and I'll ask you back for $1,100, $1,000 plus $100 interest. That's Ribbis. Standard ISCA is I will lend you $500, get back $500. I will give you $500 to invest at the expected return of 20%. 20% of 500 being 100, so I get back 600 on the investment, 500 in loan. Again, I end up with 1100. In this new version, the Kulo Pikaron version, I give you no loan at all. I'm giving you $1,000 to invest, and I expect back 10%. Now, what are the advantages of that? There are some halachic advantages. One advantage, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has a tshuva where he says he's not going to question the whole Eter Iska thing. He understands that that's accepted practice, but he has a kasha on the whole thing. He says the rate of return that you're guaranteeing the guy is a pretty high rate. So what I was alluding to before, that 40% is certainly not really realistic. 20% is already a very high rate. So why are you guaranteeing an investor such a high rate? Most investors expect a much lower rate. And here you're guaranteeing a rate of 20%. Why are you doing that? Sounds like you're doing that because he's lent you money. So it sounds like the whole situation kind of smells of rivers to begin with. So Rav Shlomo Zalman raised that objection to the whole ISCA formulation. So if you have a Kulo Pikaron form, you don't really have that problem. A Kulo Pikaron, the main advantage really, is that there is no halva at all. There's no loan. So once you have no loan, so really by definition, you can't have ribis. Ribis min haTorah, for sure, is going to require a loan. If there's no loan, it's all an investment. You don't have any potential ribis issues to begin with. Some also recommended, in terms of the point I mentioned before, that maybe a Kulo Pikaron form should be used, especially if dealing with a person who's perhaps not religious or not educated, who's not going to understand this whole scenario, maybe better to deal with a Pikaron form straight out, not get involved in any kind of halva at all. And this also helps mitigate a little bit Rav Shlomo Zalman's concern, because now we don't have to worry about why do you have this very high rate of return. It's because of a loan. Now the rate of return is cut in half, and it's more reasonable, and there is no loan. So the objection that Rav Shlomo Zalman raised is theoretically addressed by this. So there are some halachic advantages to the Kulo Pikaron form. The major disadvantage is that now the lender is at risk for everything. Right? We said that the lender, by using a ISCA as opposed to a straight loan, so the price he pays for trying to get a return out of the money he's laying out is that he has to adopt some risk. He has to assume some risk on the investment portion. So if we've made the investment 100% instead of 50%, so now he's running a higher risk. So that is a reason he might not want to do it. That's essentially a reason not to do it. So there are scenarios where a Kulo Pikaron form is more appropriate, Kulo Pikaron form is less appropriate, and that's also part of the consideration. Maybe this should also exist to be used for those types of circumstances. Actually, Chesky, maybe look again at the form that you called up. It sounded like that was actually a Kulo Pikaron form, right? You didn't characterize it half as a loan and half as...
It says for the purpose of transacting business in connection with whoever, right, in which profits and losses are to be equally shared. However, it said, as agreed, that in lieu of the sharing of profits and losses, like, he's talking about sharing here, but I guess maybe the whole...
There's no talk of a loan at all.
Right, yeah, that's just about the profits. Yeah,
right, so it sounds like it's a Kulo Pikaron form.
It has, like, this little paragraph ahead, which maybe,
it's anything.
Jewish religious law strictly prohibits the paying or receiving of interest on loans made between Jews. However, when monies are advanced in the course of a business transaction, an agreement may be entered into whereby the provider and receiver of these funds are considered equal partners. This partnership is based upon the stipulation that, upon request, every loss must be attested to by two trustworthy witnesses, and all profits verified by oath. All consequent profits and losses are then equally shared. However, in order to avoid these very stringent requirements, the provider of the funds, under the Shinar Iska, agrees to waive his share of the profits in lieu of receiving a fixed percentage of the money advanced. This percentage is then considered profit rather than interest on a loan. This agreement becomes effective when the receiver of the funds executes a form as set forth.
Right, so it seems like it's a Kulo Pikaron form. There's no mention of it being 50% one thing, 50% something else. So that's basically the downside for the lender, is that he assumes some small percentage of risk on everything. So if the guy ended up taking the money and giving it to Bernie Madoff, so then the lender loses everything. And there's many ways in which it's halachically a little safer, but it means that the lender exposes himself to much more risk, where if he really wanted to expose himself to that much risk, he would have just made a normal investment to begin with. So, you know, it may or may not be amenable to the person who's involved. Hi.
You would only lose it if it's like a well-known thing, right?
Or if the guy takes a shvua, or it's a lower level of risk that you would have with a normal investment, but there is some risk. And again, the risk in a conceptual perspective, the risk is good for us because it makes the whole thing more genuine. But at the same time, the lender may not want to do that. There is a third type of heteriska. And this is common in businesses in Eretz Yisrael. This was first suggested by Rav Legele Eger in a Torah journal a couple of years ago. There was a lot of back and forth about it. Not everyone accepted it, but it has been pretty much widely in use. I think nowadays they call this the heteriska of Bnei Brak, if I'm not confusing it with something else. That the idea is that, let's say you have a business that essentially all the time is doing transactions that could be characterized as ribbis. A bank, for example. You have a Jewish bank. So if you recall, last week we talked about banks and all kinds of other corporations and businesses where you have ribbis questions. And we discussed last week how you could address those ribbis questions if they are addressable and if everyone agrees or not. And then we said if you can't address them, so you're machmir. So what does machmir mean? So machmir essentially means you use a heteriska, otherwise they don't exist. Or the bank clearly only exists by taking something like ribbis. So either they assume that it's permissible because of the various svaras that were discussed last week, or because they have a heteriska. So the heteriska, there is a form, it's also called the heteriska klalis, and basically it's a general heteriska, that this business has essentially a declaration that they don't have to repeat with every customer, that basically says that this is our understanding, that all the transactions taking place here are under this understanding, and that that should be effective to kind of address everything they do. Yosef?
The customer has to know these conditions.
Presumably, you know, or presumably he should know. There's a whole question in general. So we have somebody sign something, so it's got tons of fine print. So theoretically, that really shouldn't be enough, except the question is it any different than anything else? So if he rents a car, if he buys a house, without the whole ribbis issue, he gets involved in any kind of major transaction, so he signs documents that have tons of fine print also, which have actual real-world impact. So is there any reason why this should be any more severe than that? Again, Rav Moshe's point notwithstanding, it's not some magical formula that you just whip it out and everything falls into place. But at the same time, it's a fair question to ask if in all other business transactions in life, which are real and genuine too, and we still don't necessarily require that you read every word of the contract, so does this make any difference? So that's a little bit of an open question. But in general, yeah, the understanding is that both parties should have a full understanding of what's going on. You know what I'm saying?
Is this just a regular heteriska with the stipulation that you don't need it's understood it's happening every single transaction?
So it seems to be. That's the basic context for all of the dealings that the business is undergoing that puts it into that framework.
So both parties have to know, and it's only for like if you do a business with the same party many times.
Well, they'll see it. You know, even any party who comes in will see that this is a part of it, hopefully. Yeah, that's the idea. Hi.
I missed the punchline of the third way.
The third way is just that it's done generally. It's not done specifically in between every two parties that...
Which one is that?
The heteriska klalis. That the business that continuously, everything they do is under these... And it's a Jewish business, and everything they do is under this framework. So they'll have that essentially announced. This is our understanding. Avi?
Is that something when you walk into like Israeli businesses, they have like a heteriska on display? They don't want that probably...
Yeah, that would be, I assume that would be a heteriska clause. right, which was controversial in terms of whether that suffices or not, but that's a widely used mechanism today. So we're going to end in a moment, but basically I just want to kind of emphasize, and I hope it's clear, that this is not some way of avoiding the law, that, again, it's really in the spirit of Lifnim Meshuras HaDin, that we should try to understand what the din is about and make sure everything is accounted for, both the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. So just as in other cases, that will mean the spirit of law will push us to do more. So here, in this case, where the spirit of the law doesn't necessarily impact on this scenario, and Chalkas Yaakov, for example, and others making the point that the viability of the Jewish community is premised on the ability to do some type of business and requires it. So then what's left is the letter of the law, and the Hetereska is there to address that. But if it's a scenario where the spirit of the law really does indicate that you should be giving a free loan, so then to take out a Hetereska in those circumstances is a contradiction both to the spirit of the law, and also is probably not functional, because it doesn't make sense. If it's not going to be a profit-generating endeavor, then it doesn't really make sense that the Hetereska would work under those circumstances anyway. So just to basically recap, what did we speak about today? We spoke about the issue of return policies that negate the sale to begin with. Is that a consideration that the purchasing becomes a loan retroactively and the usage of the object is a interest to some type of ribis? So it does look like it a little bit, so therefore the recommendations are, among other things, that it be characterized as a new sale and not a retroactive negation of the original sale, and other similar remedies. And then we talked about the Hetereska, which is there to make business investment possible when it's not there as a chesed type of loan. And there were basically three approaches, three different styles. The primary Hetereska is known as chatzi milva chatzi pikadon, that the person lends straight out half of the sum and gets that back as is. The other half is characterized as an investment with a certain guaranteed return, which would roughly be twice the rate of interest. And the return is guaranteed by the fact that if the person wants to say he lost the money or he has less than that full rate of return, he would have to take a shvua or have too difficult to obtain edim come and prove the point. And if he doesn't want to do that, he has recourse to this set rate. And it is possible that he may do that recourse, he may take the other way, and the lender may actually lose out that half of the advanced funds, and that's part of the risk he's taking, and that risk is good for us because it does make the investment part of it more genuine. Chesky?
Yeah, just that we've been like focusing on this understanding that the principles working behind ribis are that it's like some sort of chesed. Mm-hmm. Like other suggestions that we talked about in the past weeks were like that it's a lack of muna on the guy's behalf, or else that money is just like this sort of commodity which you cannot really, you know, lend out as like an object other than money. So because of that, like from those perspectives, there's really nothing being accomplished here in terms of whether or not we're going against the spirit of the law. Like we certainly are, because like it's definitely the lack of a muna or whatever. Like what we were saying last week, that you just lend money with interest.
Yeah, I don't think so, because I think that the muna is not that you will always get more money. You'll have the money you need. The amuna is that if you're engaging in chesed, you don't need to have that chesed guaranteed with a return like putting it in the bank. But in these scenarios, you're not really engaging in chesed. Your motivation is not that this is a starving person who needs a loan or he'll get kicked out of his apartment. This is a guy who's living life fine but who wants to profit off business, so he needs your help in order to do so. So the whole chesed component is not there. And it seems to be all the explanations we gave are relevant in a context where a person is supposed to otherwise be giving a straight-out chesed without any other kind of guarantees or considerations.
It's not called chesed still. Like, I mean, I understood that.
Yeah, the guy's happier that you did it. It's a benefit to this person.
Right.
But it's not a chesed in the sense that you're...
brotherhood or whatever we were talking about also.
Right, the brotherhood is also there because of the chesed, that when your brother's in need... Everything is premised on the scenario being a chesed kind of motivation. But if it's not that the guy is starving, the guy wants to profit from the business, so he, so he won't be starving in the future. True, but that's where it's coming from. So that's where this motivation. Now, it's certainly possible that the Torah and the Chafetz Chaim on some level would say that if you can get away with, if you're able to keep businesses going without Hetereska, that would also be better. It's certainly possible you would have such an attitude, but again, there is somewhat of a back and forth in terms of what attitude has been appropriate over the years, and this has kind of been the contemporary view on things. So that was one type of heteriska. The other heteriska is to do a kulo picado and not have any part of a milva at all, which has a number of advantages to it, because if there's no loam, then there's no potential ribbis, and you're totally inoculated against that, and the rate of return can be more reasonable, and many other such problems. It's more, it's easier to understand, but the downside is that the lender exposes himself to risk on the entire Karen, however small the risk is, but the risk now applies to all of his money rather than just half of it. And the third model is the Heteriska Klalis that businesses, particularly in Israel and elsewhere, use in order to characterize their entire Jewish-owned business as one that is operating under these structures. All right, so we'll stop here. Next week, how many weeks do we have before Pesach after today?
Two. We have a class that last Monday.
We just have two classes between now and Pesach?
All right. I don't know. We might have. I think there's a third Wednesday. I don't know like what the schedule is.
All right. So we want to talk about Mechiras Chametz, and we want to talk about owning Chametz. Sorry?
All of them.
And how many classes do we have after Pesach?
I think two.
And how many after Pesach?
What's today's date?
Fine.
Yeah, it's only two.
It's
2 weeks
after. All right. We have to have a review session. It would have been better to have the review before Pesach, because we'll have to review right after Pesach. It'll probably be the review session. And between now and Pesach, we'll talk about corporations and Mecheres Chametz. And we will end that, and we'll daven Maariv quickly. All right. Who's davening for us? Joseph, you're elected. Very nice. Yeah.